Oops, sorry, I always forget you. I mean, I don't really forget you, but opening a meeting of the House Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee on Tuesday, May 9th, 2017. And folks, we have four public hearings on today's agenda. We're going to jump right in. And I don't know what order you have, but we're going to start with public hearing on Senate Bill 253A. We have several esteemed testifiers for that. And I don't, you can all come up together. Separately.
I'm not going to be shy. All right.
Well, we're going to wait. She's a little under the weather.
Someone sit next to me. I don't blame them.
Are you kidding? We're locked. We're in this together. We're in this together.
Delighted that you're well enough to come in today.
We're good. We're good.
Thank you. If you don't mind, I have my vitamin water with me.
Well, let me do the official announcement here. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 253A. And Laura, if you'd provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 253A would require the community colleges and universities provide the following information to students annually in a plain language format. The total estimate of federal education loans, total projected payoff amount, including both the principal and interest, monthly payment estimate, percentage of borrowing limit student has reached to date, total cumulative amount of tuition and fees student has paid to the institution, and a statement that the information provided does not include private loans or credit card debt. There was a fiscal impact issued in the Senate, no revenue impact for the bill.
Yeah, thank you. And AG.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon, Vice Chairs Alonzo Leon and Wisnant, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm Oregon's Attorney General. And I do want to apologize in advance. Don't think my voice will give out, but I have been a little bit under the weather. I'm honored to be able to be here to testify before you. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 253, which comes to you from the Senate Education Committee and out of the Senate with unanimous bipartisan support. When I was sworn in on January 4th for my second term as your Attorney General, one of the promises I made was to help Oregonians of all ages who are saddled by student debt. This has been a priority for my entire administration. My personal story, and perhaps some of yours, is that I had very little debt after college and law school. It hardly cost anything to go to the U of O back then, and as some of you know, I'm a double duck. It never occurred to me that I should pick a job based on income that would be necessary to repay student loans. I never thought of postponing important life decisions because my education had saddled me with debt. My payments were $34.83 a month for 10 years. This was in the 70s and the 80s. I now realize that my light load of student debt has contributed to my ability to have a career focused primarily on public service. And while I realize that times have changed, it's my hope that our kids and our grandkids will be able to make life choices for reasons and on bases other than the amount of student debt they carry. As Oregon Attorney General, I've served as a member of the National Association of Attorneys General, more commonly referred to as NAG. As a member of NAG, I join with other attorneys general from all parts of the country in discussing the common problems facing our states. In recent years, NAG has become increasingly concerned with the ever-growing problem of unmanageable student debt. A year ago, exactly, serving in my capacity as chair of the Conference of Western Attorneys General, I hosted a program entitled Student Debt, the Obligation of a Lifetime. At this conference here in Portland, a diverse range of stakeholders offered a widely shared reality. Student debt has indeed become the obligation of a lifetime, an anchor that weighs heavy on decisions like getting married, buying a house, starting a business, or even having a child. There's mounting evidence that student debt has risen to such incredible levels that it has become a serious headwind against the economic growth of the nation as a whole. Students attending Oregon's colleges come from diverse social and economic backgrounds, but one thing they increasingly have in common is their reliance on student loans to pay for their education. Unfortunately, student loan debt is now the second largest category of consumer debt in the country. In fact, since 2004, education debt in the U.S. has more than tripled, totaling over $1 trillion today. It's actually $1.4 trillion. Perhaps it's not surprising, then, that Americans collectively owe more on their student loans than they do on either their auto loans or credit cards. Here in Oregon, the graduating class of 2015 saw 63% of its students graduate with student loan debt. The tremendous cost of higher education has placed a particular burden on older adults. Although most student loan borrowers are young adults between the ages of 18 and 39, consumers age 60 and older are actually the fastest growing segment of the student loan market. According to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the number of older student loan borrowers has quadrupled since 2005. Unless you think that everybody's just going back to school, probably a lot of that has to do with grandparents and others providing some additional loan assistance to their children and grandchildren. In 2012, the University of Indiana was struggling to find a way to deal with the growing amount of student debt and was troubled by an increase in student loan defaults. That year, the university decided to try something new. They began sending an email to their student borrowers, telling them what their monthly payment would be after graduation and the potential total payoff amount of their loans. When students received that information, it had almost an immediate effect on their willingness to borrow. Almost immediately, students armed with a more understandable notion of the impact of their debt began making different decisions. And they didn't decide not to go to school, so made some different decisions about how they were going to spend the money. In that first year, federal undergraduate Stafford loan disbursements at the university dropped by 11%, or $31 million. And by 2014, IU officials reported that their undergraduate borrowing had dropped by over 16% since 2012. And we have some backup sites for you on that. After seeing the success of that initiative, in 2015, the Indiana legislature took IU's innovation statewide with a law requiring every institution to give student borrowers the same information that IU had provided their students. The following year, Nebraska passed an almost identical bill with unanimous bipartisan support, and Wisconsin followed suit in 2016. And just last month, our neighbors to the north in Washington also passed a bill that replicates the Indiana model. In Indiana, Nebraska, and Wisconsin, all of the required institutions have fully implemented the requirements of this proposal and reported a minimal fiscal impact. In fact, my office has reached out to both Indiana and Nebraska, and they confirmed that all of their schools were able to fully comply with these new requirements at little or no cost to the schools. It's not painful for me. I hope it's not for you. Members of the committee, the bill in front of you today requires institutions of higher education in Oregon to provide students with basic information about their education loans that is easy to understand and will help them make more informed borrowing decisions. Just like the Indiana initiative, each year students must be given an estimate of the total amount of education loans they have received at that time and an estimate of the total potential payoff amount, including interest, for those loans. Most importantly, Senate Bill 253 requires an estimate of the amount the student will have to pay each month after graduation to service their current loan. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of this particular data point. The financial obligations of higher education are enormous, and the scale can be hard to understand. Asking a student who is early in their financial independence and often only months removed from living with their parents to understand the magnitude and the long-term responsibility of assuming $20,000 or $30,000 in debt is a tall task. And unfortunately, recent studies have shown that financial literacy varies dramatically among students entering college today. For all of our students, but especially those without a strong understanding of their finances, it's far easier to understand a debt expressed in terms of $300 per month, a figure that they can compare to rent, books, gas, car payments, or even coffee. Hopefully they don't spend that much on coffee. Providing our students with this easy-to-understand information each year will give them a better sense of how their education loans will impact their lives upon graduation. Equipped with this knowledge, Oregon students will be able to make better informed borrowing decisions, potentially saving thousands of dollars in debt, and that is something I hope each of you will be able to join me in supporting. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I am happy to take questions, although I know we have some wonderful speakers to follow me.
I'd like to hear the other testimony first. That's
okay.
Thank you.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. I'm certain it's no surprise to you that many college and university graduates are struggling with student loan debt. Nationally, nearly approximately $1.3 trillion in education debt are owed collectively by approximately 44 million borrowers. In Oregon, nearly two-thirds of graduates in 2015 graduated with student loan debt, with a statewide average of $27,697 per borrower. That's why over the interim, the Attorney General's office shared with me the concept that would become Senate Bill 253A. I was thrilled to have an opportunity to partner on something that would be beneficial to so many students across our state, and I'm thankful to Representative Huffman for working on this with me as well. Senate Bill 253A seeks to address the issue of unnecessary student loan debt by improving borrowers' knowledge of the entirety of the loans they are taking on, including the total payoff amount they will owe upon graduation based on their current federal education loans and estimates of their monthly payments, including interest. It additionally will make clear what portion of the student's loan is going towards tuition versus non-tuition costs. This simplified information will help students make informed decisions when taking on loans and choosing how to spend those funds. The information will be compiled and distributed by the higher education institutions on an annual basis at a time and a manner of their choosing, in a format that is easy for students to understand so that schools can make individual decisions about what is most appropriate for their institutions and their student population. While the concept sounds simple, its potential positive impacts are significant. Recent research found that when Indiana University, as our Attorney General mentioned, began sending students annual notifications like these, which estimated their total education loan debt and potential future monthly payments after graduation, they saw undergraduate borrowing rates drop by approximately 16%. By increasing students' financial literacy, they will be more likely to seek out scholarships and think about their spending habits more carefully, hopefully choosing to avoid frivolous spending and deciding to choose a course path that is cost-effective. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, I appreciate your time today and appreciate that you're taking the Senate Bill 253A for consideration. I'm going to turn it over to Representative Huffman, and I think we have staff from the Attorney General's office. And I want to just make a note that on the Senate side, again, the bill did pass out of the Senate unanimously. And I'd like to mention that we don't do that a lot on the Senate, and so Senate side. And just to show that there was a lot of discussion about this bill amongst members on the Senate side, and we are quite convinced that this is a good measure and that it can be done in a cost-effective way within the with a minimal fiscal impact. So,
okay. Well, thank you for your being here, and we'll hear what Representative Huffman has to say, and then I'm sure there will be a few questions.
Thank you, Chair Reardon and Committee. John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59, and a proud chief sponsor of this bill. I sat on this committee for 3 or 4 biennia, a long time. And I think every year we were having conversations about increasing student debt, the burden of their loans, and that's why I jumped at the chance when the Attorney General and Senator Taylor called and said, would you like to join in on this bill? It's like, this is a bill of substance that we can stop talking about it and actually do something. So I talked to John Wyckoff off from community colleges off the floor this morning. And I said, I don't know what the conversations were in the Senate. Somehow the bill passed through the committee and the Senate floor unanimously. But now we're having a lot of discussions and I think probably centered around some misunderstandings. And I said, let's have a good hearing this afternoon and get everybody's thoughts and feelings on the table. And then you know, figure out how we can make this work for the students, because it's about the students. I think Josh put this in OLIS, but this is the Indiana one-sheet model. It's pretty simple. And as I was thinking about this today, I thought, you know, how can I have the most thought-provoking testimony? Because I knew that the Attorney General and Senator Taylor would cover a lot of the material. But I thought, you know, I'm a business guy. I've done a lot of finance in my life, and I got to thinking, you know, when somebody goes out and buys a car, there's a credit check, you sit down with a finance person, you go over the contract, it's pointed out what your principal is, what your interest is, what your monthly payments are. When you buy a home, you go to your mortgage broker, your banker, and you sit down, and the same thing. They've done a credit check, and you sit down with the contract, and you go over all the papers in a stack that's about like that now. And I thought, you know, the two areas that we seem to be struggling with the most in this country are student debt, student loans, and consumer credit. You know, people get in serious trouble with credit cards, and they get in serious trouble with student loans. And it seems to be that that's the area where we're missing the steps of sitting down with a loan officer or somebody to explain, this is what this is going to mean in your life. This is what it's going to mean to your budget. These are the monthly payments. And when you look at a lot of the students in college today that maybe 22, 23 years old, a lot of them never purchased a home. They don't have a mortgage. They've never sat down with a loan officer to go over a contract like that. They've oftentimes got a credit card that they owe way too much on in addition to their student loans. And I just think that we have a tool here where we can turn this around and stop talking about it, and we can really educate students about what their indebtedness is really going to mean to them in a monthly budget. And if you get out of school and you go to work as a social worker for $24,000 a year and you've got $28,000 in student debt, how's that going to work? Well, it's not. But they don't find that out until it's too late. So, Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to testify. And I was going to drone on a lot longer because I know that Representative Bynum was really hoping I would. And you didn't move too far from last hour, I noticed, too. You just kind of went down one chair. But thank you. I appreciate the time.
Well, we happy to answer questions. Appreciate your droning with us today. So it's always a pleasure having you here. So. Sure. Committee, questions for this panel?
I have a question.
Sure. I was hoping you would. Representative Lanzo-Leon.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this bill. One of the questions that I had was, I know that we have calculators out there already. Universities offer these calculators, and I wanted to understand what the difference in information those calculators provided and what this bill provides. And fortunately, we have staff that was able to find out. Mm-hmm. And those calculators give some of this basic information, but not all of it. And those calculators are not, what I've learned is that folks really don't use them. They're not either because of, they're not accessible or they're not very clear to function. And I've worked with young people pretty much all of my educational career and helping students figure out their opportunities to go to college. That's where I was able to kind of work with students. And information is even financial aid packages. They tell you how much loans, how much you're eligible to take, but it doesn't explain to you if you take this loan out, This is the interest rate, and this is how long it'll take you to pay. So it doesn't even give you that information. So so I'm really appreciating the more I learn how this bill is going to help students. And then I think where it really resonated was thinking about having precisely what you said, representative, that we have loans out there, and there's information that allows you to better understand that our student loan system doesn't provide that. Understanding that a lot of these students, especially first-generation low-income students, probably have not had this financial literacy background, and it's hard for them to understand. So if it's not presented in a very basic, general manner, it won't make sense. And so I appreciate the one-pager that does make sense. Because from my personal experience talking to parents about how even a $2,000 loan will impact them, and having it very, very in simplistic terms to help them is really beneficial. So the more I learn about this bill, and the more I ask questions about this bill, the more I support this bill. So thank you for bringing this bill up.
Thank you. Chair Reardon.
Can I interject something that I had left out? I wanted to make clear that we're only asking the universities and colleges and community colleges to be responsible for what they're responsible for. There was some concern that I talked to Cindy Robert, and she pointed out that they can't be responsible. They can't gather the information if a student has previous loans, private loans, or whatever. And that's true.
Right.
And they're not responsible for that. The colleges and universities are only responsible for the loans that the student is getting ready to take out while they're in their institution. And I hope I worded that accurately. And we do have Josh Bidwell, Mr. Expert, that has done a phenomenal amount of heavy lifting on this bill that can answer a lot of the detailed questions also.
Thank you for that clarification. Ripper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all three of you for bringing this bill forward. It sounds like a great concept and a great bill. You talked a little bit about the state of Indiana and how they've had legislation in place that's doing similar things. Is there any difference, big differences, between this legislation and what they currently have in place?
Chair Reardon, Representative Hurd, I believe Josh has a PowerPoint where he can show you a comparison. It's very similar. There are some differences, I believe.
Thank you.
Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Rep. Solomon.
Thanks, Chair Reardon. I really appreciate you bringing this forward as well. I know that a lot of us have talked about this and really had shared concern in this as well. And I just want to say, I think that it was Rep. Wisnett that brought forward in the Education Committee about financial literacy. You know, bringing that forward and talking about even that earlier in a high school program that really gives people a deeper understanding, students a deeper understanding as to what they're, looking at for their future debt opportunities and schools and cars and different things like that. I like the concept of making sure that people know what they're looking at and what their potential long-range plan can be. It is key. I talk about this a lot. My future daughter-in-law has a second-year elementary teacher, has an incredible amount of student debt, started out at a private college, transferred to a state college. And it's concerning. I mean, she's very stressed at the amount of debt that she pays in a monthly payment every month. I really want us to look at how we can even push this back as far as letting students know and understand the different pathways in their high school. So giving them that pathway information, you know, this is what your college, you know, debt would look like. This is community college. This is trade college. So I'm wondering when you are, I saw the fiscal on, I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. And I'm wondering that my son receives an invoice every term with his college bill. I think it would be extremely beneficial that attached with that shows the breakdown that you have just taken on this debt. I do think having it in front of someone, having it in front of the parents, I even like it to go a little bit further to say, yes, these are deferred, but wow, what a great opportunity for you to pay an additional $100 to $200. This is how much you could even reduce your debt by if you were able to do this. I just think it may be an online calculator, but I don't think enough people are even going to it. So I'm I realize that that could be the part of the large fiscal part of this, but it is getting, you're connecting that invoice with that real information. And I'm interested in learning more about these other state programs. And yeah, those are my mixed up.
All right.
Thank you.
Chair Reardon, if I could address that quickly.
I'm going to. I've got six more people to come up behind you, so go ahead.
We are working with community colleges particularly on the fiscal, trying to determine what they're not seeing or what we're not seeing when other states have done it with little or no fiscal. And so we are communicating with everybody, trying to make sure that we get everybody's questions answered.
Seems like there was a language.
Real quick. Obviously, the students have better information about their purchasing decisions, how that affects their future life. That would be helpful, and I think this is one way to do that. Just out of curiosity, was there any other approach other than handing them this sheet of information that anybody explore any other ideas that might be just as effective? I don't know that you have. But.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, this idea came up during that symposium that I mentioned to you. We had presentations from the various states that had already done various types of things. There were a number of different options.
Okay.
This was the simplest. Frankly, it seemed like the cheapest. And we thought that it really dealt with the lack of financial literacy at the early stages. So we were taken by this and thought that it had the best shot, quite honestly. There's lots going on in this area. Happy to bring back other ideas. We thought this was the one that we should present.
The nag and the wag liked it.
Representative, I just want to clarify one thing. This is what we're proposing would be something that's done online. When students are in school now, they're all of their loan processing, etc., that's all happening electronically. So this would happen online. There wouldn't be an actual delivery of a piece of paper, just so
okay.
I understand.
Okay. Thank you all three for bringing us to us today.
Chair,
appreciate it.
Oh,
or maybe we have one more question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony and for bringing this forward. And I'm glad this committee has worked hard to help this financial issue for the time I've been. I think it's only three sessions,
was
Representative.
It?
But that's all we had in existence. Everything used to be under education. In our research, we found that there's an online student loan calculator. Are you familiar with that service that all Oregon students can go online and do that now? Did you know that?
Mm-hmm. We, Mr. Chair and Rep Wisnett, we had that conversation when you were out of the building.
Oh, I apologize.
Building, and the chair wants us to move on. We're happy to talk about it again. But
no, thank you. Apologize.
Not a problem.
No, that's fine.
He's doing double duty today.
He is. Hard working.
Hard working committee.
Go forth and do it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we have up next, I lost my sheet. We have right here. John White.
Josh.
Oh, Josh. Okay, excuse me. Josh Bidwell.
Thank you, Chair Reardon, Vice Chairs Lonzo Leon and Wisnett. I was hoping you were going to call me up, but I was going to politely wait until you did. I don't want to belabor the point because that last panel did an excellent job describing what the bill does and what the whole idea was behind it, but our office thought it was important for you all to see what is happening now in our schools, what students are getting now, just side by side with what the Indiana model looks like, just so you have that visual in your head. So this is everything that I'm about to go through is available on OLIS and was either submitted by the schools in the last public hearing or by us in this current hearing. So this is an example of something like what one of our students might be getting currently. It does have on there, you'll see, it has total numbers. This is an annual award, so it's got total numbers, but just for an annual amount. It has tuition and fees, but again, just for the annual. And it's not particularly clear the difference between your grants, your scholarships, your loan amounts, and that total number there. You move on, and there's another page. Where is it? And this is the area that is theoretically plain language and giving them good information about these loans. On OLIS, you can read this slightly better, but it, in reality, it is not much bigger print than this is currently. Can I go back? Down here, you'll see a little box that has the aggregate amount of loans that the student is allowed to take out per year. One of the things that this bill requires is that the students get that information for the lifetime of their attendance on this notification. You'll have another page of explanations about repayment plans and various other tools where students can go and find this information out on their own. So doing what our legislation will theoretically put in front of their face, this is giving them the opportunity to go and find it out on their own, theoretically. This is another, I believe one of the members asked about, you know, the Rep. Solomon, what happens when they get the actual disbursements. This is an example of what that looks like and what the students are seeing. So, you know, pairing this letter with that disbursement.
I'm trying to find it on OLIS. What's it under?
I believe it's, called presentation. It was submitted, I think, under a DOJ. I saw it earlier.
It should be a PowerPoint on OLIS.
There's a lot of stuff. Her and I are both trying to find it. My eyes don't see very well, so.
Yeah.
Now that I'm getting old and all that. Mm-hmm.
Did you look into the I'd be happy to bring this hard copy up to y'all if that would be helpful.
That's it.
Found
it.
That's it.
Wonderful. And so that was kind of like what our students are getting currently. This next slide is going to be the Indiana model and what I consider and what our office is the standard of this idea. And you can see here, gives you the total amount of your education loans, what the standard repayment plan they're assuming for you, the interest rate they're assuming for you, and then what a monthly payment's going to look like for you when you have to start paying on these loans, whenever that is. And that number right there is, these two are the kickers. That shows them how much they're actually going to be paying every month. That shows them how much they're actually going to be paying in the long run. And that's the interest they're accruing. And so you can just kind of see the difference between the two. And then they have an additional page that allows students to go to the same links, same resources, gives them a number of other little tidbits there.
Tidbits.
There are a number of tidbits.
There are a lot of bits.
The Nebraska Community College, I spoke with folks out in Nebraska, and they put me in touch with the financial aid director out there, and some of their resources weren't quite up to the same level as some of their larger universities. And so what they do is a little bit more boilerplate. They still give the student an example or whatever their total amount is, and then they give them the amount of the borrowing limit that they've reached. And then at the bottom, they have just a nice chart that says, you know, here's your debt amount. If it's an interest rate XYZ, here's your monthly repayments, and here's your total repayment amount. And so it's not nearly as right there individualized for that exact student, but it is right in front of that student's face. They just have to look down in that box and just go straight across the line. And so this is something that we think is also an option for our schools if they don't think they can do that letter model for some reason. And then the other thing I just wanted to hit on was that fiscal issue. And I have spoken to Nebraska and Indiana both and confirmed after the fact, not only did they not anticipate a fiscal in the legislative process, I followed up and said, you know, did it actually cost your schools, was it a burden on your schools to implement this? And I got a resounding no from both of those states. So every state that's implemented this thus far, and I can't speak to the specifics of how they've done it, but they've done it with little or no fiscal. And that's all I've got for you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Rep. Solomon.
Thanks, Chair. Is it possible, is it because there was more of a generic versus a personal? So rather than Joe Smith, here is what your thing looks like compared to this is on the average, here's a, that's where the fiscal and the non.
That is a possibility. The way we interpret our language, I don't think that should be an issue, but I could see that as a possibility, but I don't. We don't believe that our language for this bill would in any way make it harder than these other states, because the language is almost verbatim, and we ask for an estimate in this language, and they ask for estimates in that language, and it's not exactly the same, and so there could be some confusion there, but we don't think that boilerplate language would be an issue.
We have other testifiers coming up that may have more direct information about the fiscal impacts as well. So
I can wait on my question then.
Okay, that'd be great.
Brief question.
Go ahead, Rupert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe I'm missing something. I was 6 minutes late. So it's just this, essentially this bill is just giving us a platform, a digital map of projection of what you're going to be looking at for payments and whatnot. It's not like we're creating some situation where we're going to have a person working at the college sitting down with Rep. Clem or myself and saying, you're going to do this to yourself. It's just, hey, you got to go here. You got to check this out. That's it.
Chair and Rep. Heard, that's exactly what they're asking for. That's exactly what this language asks for, is give the student, in whatever format you feel is most appropriate and easiest for them to access, this information.
Hopefully somebody coming up can tell us where that fiscal is coming from. Then,
I'm sure.
I'm confused.
We'll get more information. Okay. Anything else?
No, sir.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Okay. We could have John Wyckoff, Lamar Wise, Cindy Robert, please. And if we could indulge us, save me. We got about 1 to 2 minutes each. You know you can do it. Clear, concise, accurate.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff, Deputy Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I did want to speak a bit about to our fiscal and what some of the differences may be. First, I would like to say we agree with are in full agreement with the overall concept behind this and the need to put information in front of students. I mean, I kind of liken it to when I was a college student, and if I knew my checking account was low, the last thing in the world I wanted to check and look at was my checking account. And if I give a student a link that says, press this link to see the giant pile of money you're going to owe at the end of your college career, I might not check that link. I fully agree with that. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. You have to put it in front of them. One of the key differences, and it's correct, most of the laws that we have looked at, and I've looked at the sort of some of the other states that the AG's office had asked us to look at, the laws are almost verbatim. I mean, it's boilerplate language for the laws. But one difference in the state of Nebraska, and I think Nebraska is a great example because they are a decentralized system, as we are. Indiana is a pretty unified system, so they have central offices that are more considerably more robust than we probably have or than do have. Whereas Nebraska is a truly decentralized system, and the difference is in Section 2, Part D of the legislation you have, it says it requires an estimate of the amount, including interest, that a student will have to pay, the word student being the critical difference. In the Nebraska statute, and this, as far as I can tell, the only difference in the statute is it says that a typical borrower would pay. So we give the student individualized information about what they currently owe, because the feds give us that, and we can provide that to the student, and then would give them that similar table to what Nebraska is. Our reading of the current language is that we would, in fact, have to give individualized payoff information based on that snapshot of what the student currently owes, and we don't believe that we would actually be able to just simply put in a table with the current language. This would be the only change we would really be asking for, is to change that one piece, making it explicit that we can use a table such as that, which actually I think you could might be better information to put in front of the students anyway, because it gives them multiple scenarios to look at. As we know, there will be other pieces of loan on here that will not be included, such as private loans, and we are only giving them that snapshot. And if it's truly tailored off that incomplete snapshot, it might not be complete information. And what the table does is allow them to look at different amounts and different interest rates, but we believe that one change in the bill would allow us to do that, and the current language does not. Our fiscal was derived from our folks feeling that, yes, you're right, right, we don't have to have someone sit down and work with a student, but what you have to do is do some significant coding within, we have three data, at least three data systems that our different colleges use, the Banner system, one called Genzibar, and a locally grown system from Rogue Community College called RogueNet, that is phasing out. But it's a significant amount of coding that has to be done at the front end. The information technology person at Lynn Benton Community College said for him it would be about 6 months of coding for just to do these individual, if you're doing it individualized on the repayment, about 6 months of work that was everything from coding to altering the program to producing new reports, customized input, data table changing, things in coding I don't particularly understand very well, and that it would be about 6 months of work including testing. Now, if you change it, if you make that slight change in the statute to mirror what they have in Nebraska, we think that removes the significant part of what our fiscal is derived from. There would still be some minor costs to make changes within the system, but they would be minor compared to what we were looking at. And that is really where our fiscal came from. And we believe with this one fairly minor change. And again, I think Nebraska is a really good state to look at because they are very similar. Their community college system is quite similar to ours in its decentralization. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Rep. Bruden, thank you. Thanks, John. That was going to be my question. You essentially answered it. I mean, having worked in the community colleges and for CCWD in the past, I know that in the state of Oregon, every institution works independently from each other, and they have different systems across all the 17 community colleges and now the universities. So that was my question, and trying to better understand the fiscal aspect of it. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, Rupert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's say we go with the more expensive option for some reason, okay? It sounds like it's a one-time upfront investment, and then the long-term benefit kicks in forever. Or is there a reoccurring?
Chair Reardon, Representative Hurd. Most likely there are multiple ways you could do it, right? If a campus were, for example, simply asking Banner to do it for them, then it would actually be an annual fee. If your whole system is in Banner, you can get sort of economies of scale and get Banner to make changes for you. But because we only have a small number of schools, they haven't had much luck trying to get changes like that. So they would probably do it in-house, especially if we went. And if you were looking at just putting a table in front of students, then that would not be particularly difficult. In fact, the financial aid director at Nebraska told me she is not an IT person, but she actually did it herself because she knows a little bit of SQL language and then had her IT person check her work. So we believe if we're producing something like that table, it's relatively easily done. For most campuses, it would probably be a one-time upfront cost to have that done.
Did I hear correctly that the state of Indiana has seen a 17% reduction in student spending?
And I don't doubt that at all. One of the things we actually looked at was getting a private contractor that could give us a consortium rate. And interestingly, they have done that, and it was a bit more expensive than what we were hoping for. But one of the things that they give students, it's much more detailed than what we're talking about here, is they give them not just what you would pay back or based on your loans, but they give you a recommended loan amount. And Western Governors University has actually adopted this, have paid this company to do it. It has brought their borrowing down 20%. And so, I mean, putting this kind of information in front of students does make a difference, and the more and if we had the resources to do something like even look at a recommended borrowing rate, that would be ideal. But we do not, without incurring some cost, have the ability to do that currently.
I think she's going to explode.
No, I'm not. It's just giving me the eyes like, please hold.
Pretty sure
his
2 minutes is up.
I'll hold.
Let's see what Mr. Wise has to say.
I'm going to try to be quick so that folks can get to their questions. But my name is Lamar Wise. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. First off, I wanted to thank the Attorney General's Office, Senator Taylor, and Representative Huffman for bringing this forward. The Oregon Student Association supports this bill, Senate Bill 253. In general, appreciate information, and especially for financial planning. We are here mainly because of the high cost of education. This wouldn't even be a problem if the cost of education wasn't as high. But we're here now, and since we are here, we believe that students should have the means and the tools to see what they're buying and what's going to cost. And so with that being said, I did want to make a couple of notes, one of which is that students also want to make sure that there's a cost-effective way in implementing this bill. So there's a lot of talk about the fiscal impact. So rest assured that we do not want this to cost money. We want an easy way for students to be able to access what their education is going to cost. And then I also wanted to say is that we're also hoping that this bill doesn't discourage students, but more so acts as a tool for students to do good financial planning, both while they're in school and after school. So we just see this as another means for students to get information. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Lamar. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. That's 18 schools in Oregon, like the one across the street. And working with 35,000 students. 32% of our students actually receive Pell Grants, and 92% of our students receive some type of financial aid. The Alliance schools believe that it is critical for students to have information about costs, grants, scholarships, loans, in order for them to make wise choices. All of our schools provide information about loans available prior to enrollment. As a matter of fact, it's kind of fun. I brought a little folder here on prior to enrollment financial worksheets that my daughter got when she, Claire Robert, was accepted to Linfield. So it's right there. And I will tell you, Claire also got the same information from OIT, where she intends to go to school. And it's actually well written, it's well done, and we hope that this same kind of information goes out every year.
Is that boilerplate?
For Linfield, it is. All our schools are do something different. I think that's one reason why, as Mr. Wyckoff pointed out, the financial changes a little bit. But my point is that our schools try really hard to do this. They may not all do it exactly the same way, but they try very hard to do it. The Alliance testified on the Senate side as to some concerns. One was specific to language and had to do with the private loan information, which schools do not have access to. They're private loans. And Senator Taylor and Representative Huffman were good enough to make changes to that, and we appreciate that. One of our other issues had to do with redundancy and costs, but we're addressing that over here, too. And again, I'm appreciative to the sponsors for allowing us to continue having that conversation, keep talking about it, and make sure it all is this simple and it all is as informative as it can be so students can make good choices.
Is that updated every year?
Yes, and per student. So this one is specific to my daughter. So it says how much FAFSA money she can get, and then how much work study she could get. Yeah. So it's for every student. And then this is before they sign up for school. So that's kind of good information right there. They're told this is what the federal loan money you could access is. And then some of the schools on a regular basis, and it's not legislative, but on a regular basis, say how often they're going to provide this information. The information that's new that you're asking for in this is how much is this going to cost you to pay off every year? That's the new information. Collecting this and doing that for each student is what would cost money. This idea of putting together not only a chart that would show them how much the federal loan would cost them, because we know about that, but also where they can add in, and my $10,000 private loan brings me down here with this payment, is really a good idea.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate everybody being here today.
Snap that.
Oh my gosh.
I've been holding off all chair. You're Mr. Chair.
I thought you had me trained to look that way by now.
That blinders on. For either one, I guess we have a community college and we have a four-year institution here. So if I'm a student who begins my career at a college where I accumulate some student debt and I transfer into a four-year institution, do you have awareness of how much debt or how many loans I've taken in my prior career before I've shown up in your institution?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm going to be very honest with you. My understanding was we did not. We did not know what money was spent at the community college. Right. That being said, I have since been told just today, just this afternoon before we came here, that, in fact, the information is available because you have to know what percent within the cap of federal loans you have reached. So that's one of the things we do need to look into and make sure that that we have that information or we don't have that information. Right now, as we talk about amendments, we'd like to see that you're responsible for information about the loans and the debt incurred while at that institution that's doing the reporting. We would like to see it done that way.
John. If I may. Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson. So what our financial aid directors will receive when a student applies for financial aid is they the feds do give you their aggregate borrowing of federal loans because you do have to know how close they're getting to that cap. Now, we can run into an issue where, and this is a minute issue, if somebody says they're going to go to OSU and they have a pending loan and then they decide to go to, say, Lynn Benton, there could be a lag while both loans are sort of in the system. But within about 15 days, that should update. And then the system isn't always as updated as soon as you'd like it to be. But we do. You would, in fact, have information about all of the federal loans a student has borrowed up to that point. Our financial aid offices get that. They have to get it. And so they would, in fact, have that. It doesn't, again, include things like the private loans. And that's why I think that why the table is attractive is because it allows them to look at what they know they have something outside of just those federal loans, and they can look at other scenarios as well.
Okay. Just for the sake of the committee, we may be running overtime if we don't manage our questions. I don't want to discourage anybody, but just
one.
Saying.
I'll cut it down from four to one.
All right.
Thank you, Chair.
Wow, what a deal.
So I just wanted to ask, I realize that schools like to have an individual type feel for per campus, but when you're looking at, when you're talking about $1.4 trillion in student debt and the need for us to really handle that and look at that at a state level, because that doesn't mean, it means economic growth that we are stunting. They're not buying homes, they're not buying cars, they're not settling. Why could we not look at a program for the community colleges that is let's build this program and then put it out to all the community colleges, rather than have this community college that's doing this table differently and their IT department's creating this, then this one's creating this. I realize that there wants to be is that a horrible, like, she didn't just say that, but
Chair Reardon, Representative Solomon, it might only be horrible to, we do have a person who actually created RogueNet, the system that they use out of Rogue, and that he might be personally offended by that. But other than that,
I think
no.
He's retiring. But I'm just saying, I think he is.
The cost is once you're on a system, moving to another system is costly. You've already got everything, you know, all of your procedures, everything got done through the one system. So there would be a pretty significant upfront cost to everybody moving. But to everybody moving to the same system, and then there are going to be differences within each college about how they use them. The universities, I assume, I don't want to speak for them, but because they all used to be part of a system, but are not any now. The legislature decided to go in the opposite direction. Had more similarity, even probably within their banner, than some of our colleges might.
I got any more, but questions? I'm going there.
I'll come see you.
Thank you much. Who knew there could be? We have three more people to testify, so we could have Ms. Richardson, Mr. Johnson, and Doug Sivers. Who knew there could be so much interest in this topic? This is great. I appreciate everybody's involvement, commitment. Obviously, a large issue. So. We're going to carry over, just for the sake of you in the audience planning your afternoons, because we know where we will be. We will carry over Senate Bill 54 to next Tuesday, and 206 can go same time. Okay, according to excellent planners that I have working with me. So 54 and 206 will carry over. So if some of you were waiting with bated breath to hear about those, we're just going to wait another week. So, okay.
Are we the right three? I couldn't hear you.
Having said all of that, it does not give 10 minutes each for this group, by the way, just saying, and we're really eager to have your testimony, but we have about another 45-minute one bill to hear after you guys go. So,
Chair Reardon and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dana Richardson. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Presidents, which is our public universities. I have a couple of fellows with me here today that can answer a lot of questions for you about process and impact. I would just quickly contribute to kind of echo some of the comments that you heard from Cindy Robert as well as John Wyckoff with regard to maybe pushing toward a Nebraska approach would be something that might be the sweet spot on this policy. And I will reserve any additional time I have for my colleagues if that's all right, but happy to answer questions as well.
Okay. Appreciate that shortness and and completeness. It was well done. Thank you.
Well, hello, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, and Wisnet, members of the committee. I'm Mike Johnson. I'm the Director of Financial Aid at Portland State University. And I'm here today as a representative of our public universities to provide a testimony on SB 253A that I hope will speak to some of the bill's details. And in the interest of time, I will not read everything I wrote either. I would like to just briefly let you know sort of what we already do. An important part of our job is not only to award financial aid to students, but also to provide them with timely, thorough, and easy-to-understand information about a variety of financial aid options. And so to that end, we award federal loans to students based on a variety of eligibility criteria, and we provide them with a lot of information to help them understand, manage, and minimize their student loan debt. Before they even get their money, student loan borrowers do entrance counseling that provides them with detailed information about the Federal Direct Loan Program, how to manage their educational expenses, other financial resources to consider when they pay for their educations, and their rights and responsibilities as borrowers. That's online. They're required to do it before we can disperse the aid, and they are informed quite extensively, and they have to do it. So that's just one thing to point out. A lot of us use the financial aid shopping sheet or a similar document that provides information to them about not just their awards, but the school's graduation rate, the indebtedness of typical borrowers. We also have information on our websites that we try to make sure the students understand what they're getting into. The financial aid shopping sheet is very different from the example of the award letter that you saw on the screen. It's a lot clearer. It's a lot more concise. Lastly, near graduation, all borrowers are required to complete exit counseling, which reinforces a lot of what they already know, and it gives them detailed information about their indebtedness and their repayment options. That, too, is a requirement. My feeling about the details of SB 253A is, in its current form, it would require us to make multiple assumptions about changeable aspects of borrowers' experiences. And just to give you some quick examples, the annual and aggregate federal direct loan limits are based on the borrower's dependency status, whether they're independent or dependent, enrollment status, full-time or part-time, undergraduate or graduate, the length of their academic programs, the loans they've borrowed from other schools, the interest rates, which are set each year. Each year, the interest rate is different on federal direct loans. So predicting that into the future is darn near impossible. And the repayment plans they choose will change dramatically the monthly payment and the overall payment, as you know how interest works. So I'm afraid that the information that would be required to provide on the loan summary sheet that I've seen an example of would give the illusion of accuracy while actually potentially be misleading. In particular, the percentage toward their aggregate limit, their aggregate limit will change dramatically as they go through their educational programs. So that's just one of my concerns, our concerns as we've spoken as a group. So I think we would also, as Dana suggested, be in support of something a little more generic, walking the students through the choices they need to make and the different outcomes they might see depending on their borrowing, rather than tell them how much they're going to be repaying and then have that change dramatically as they stay in school. So with that, I would stop and also offer to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Severs, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Doug Severs from Oregon State University, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair is Alonzo Leon and Wisnet. Thank you for having me here to speak today. As we get started, I just want to say thank you for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I rarely get a chance to speak to folks like you, and that's one thing that can really reduce student debt level, so appreciate that. Well, I'm here to support what Mike said. In operation, financial aid is a very complex process with complex the amounts of money the students will receive based on years in school, different aggregates based on dependent independent. I just think we need to be very careful with the information we provide to students, make sure they have fairly accurate information. It can change at a moment. We have times where students, where in our systems we show they've borrowed so much in a year, and then we get a record in from another school they went in the summer, and we have to revise their financial aid award. So these things you'll really have to consider in regard to setting up a system where it's going to provide them this direct information, what they owe. And also, I'm a little concerned having that loan money right in their face. I don't want students to be scared away of continuing their education. We really want to make sure that they understand they have multiple repayment methods, income contingent, so they can get an idea that even though they may need to go in debt to get this education, that there are ways that can ameliorate their situation. So I think it's a process. This process, I think, will be very helpful to students. But these things we all have to consider. And if you can get more input from the financial aid community as you go forward in regard to the implementation of this program, I think that would be greatly helpful. So if you have any questions, I can help you on that.
Not really a question, more of a statement. I guess the topic about, because that's not the first time I've heard that, the topic about potentially scaring students away because you give them a real-world example of what their future can be if they are not careful about their investment, I kind of struggle with being concerned about that, because if we're doing an adequate job of helping them find the right investment of their time and their resources to go to college, they should understand that, okay, this is going to make me money in the future, right. So therefore it's worth the investment. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that it would give us added incentive to help guide them through the right channels rather than going into something that they're going to lose money in the future rather than make money while they're servicing this debt. So that's just my thoughts.
Nobody on this side?
I could, but I won't.
Okay. No, we bought some time. Rep. Schulman.
Thank you, Chair. I am curious, when you're thinking about what would be the possibility, as I mentioned, my son gets an invoice every term, and here's the amount of what your invoice is, and you break it down to that specific part right there. So you just borrowed $3,800 for this term. These are your subsidized, your unsubsidized. This is what your rate is. Giving them the plan there, but also underneath that, saying that if you made the $100 a month payment, this is how much you just reduced that by that amount. Instead of looking at your, because I do get the one, whoever pointed that out, the 1 year snapshot, you know, I get that. I worry about generic. I worry about being so generic that it just doesn't grab you. On your credit card statement, you have all that gobbly stuff on the end that says your rate is 12.9% and this and that, and you just don't pay attention because you don't really see the real where it's hitting you. Where it hits you is when you go to a financial planner and they say you have $6,000 in credit card debt at this percentage. This is what you need to pay this off, you know. So the generic, I just don't think that we're gonna kick the $1.4 trillion. And I want people to make a strong investment, but I support what Rep. Hurd said, and that the bottom line shouldn't scare them. It should scare them, and what does scare them is when they graduate and now they have $90,000 in debt and they're paying $760 a month and they're not able to buy a house or buy anything. That scares them a lot.
You've given us a lot to think about, and you gave me some new information here. So we may want to follow up with you after this.
That's crazy. Thank you.
Okay, how are we doing here? Okay, I'm going to close. Thank you all for being here. Super, super helpful. Refreshki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before, are you about to close? Because I just had a comment real quick, and that is that debt's one thing, but income's another. So if you have a student who has, let's say, a $50,000 worth of school debt, and they're going to be a teacher, and they're going to make $40,000 a year, That's concerning. But if you have $50,000 in debt and you graduate with a computer science and you go work for Google for $150,000 a year, that's not concerning. So we're giving them half the picture. This is what you're going to owe. But we're not giving them the other half of the picture. This is the income you can expect to get with this degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if we're going to talk a little bit, I'd like to see all this information provided at the high school level. So you can compare career paths and the cost of different careers and start making that decision earlier. So we can work on that maybe later. So what are we doing? So I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 253. And thank you for your patience, those out in the audience waiting. Opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 207A. Laura, please provide the committee with a brief summary.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 207A would require public universities and community colleges to give credit, beginning with the 2018-2019 school year, for students who participated in advanced placement, or AP, programs and received a successful grade on nationwide examination. It defines successful grade as score of 3 or higher on the AP exam. The bill had minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact in the Senate.
Okay, we do have 8 people signed up to testify on this bill, so I'd like to start with Senator Roebling and then the College Board folks, since they've traveled from out of town. So, Senator, thank you for being here. Sorry to make you wait for so long, but I hope you found it entertaining.
I was chair of a committee. We got it done, so it worked out fine.
Good?
Yeah, yours are all done, on their way. They have assigned
people. You really are asking for rebuttal on this or on doneness of bills? Or?
Well, only wanted to make sure I could be here in time for you, sir.
Okay.
So anything I can do. So for the record, Arnie Roebling, State Senate, District 5. My district goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and then over into Sheridan and Falls City, parts of 7 counties. This has been a bill that's important to me. You have in your record a little article I found this weekend that has to do with these high-performing schools and how they've done in some of the more difficult neighborhoods and how they've turned their schools around in large part because of AP courses and IB programs in areas where most people didn't think those kids could be successful. And so for me, the reason that I really wanted to have this conversation, it goes back to what education is all about, and that's how do we help kids make good decisions and put their time and effort in and then have that time and effort pay off for parents and for themselves. I get frustrated at times with the university systems and the community college systems and saying that they've got to make sure that everything is academically at such and such a level. I think that it's important. The real importance is that we teach students the ability to understand how hard they have to work, what rigor really is, and how, if they do that, they can transfer that knowledge in lots of different ways. And as a high school teacher, we get kids that transfer all over the country. Some of them are Coast Guard families on the coast. Some of them are others. They show up with a transcript, and they say, here it is. And it comes from schools from all over the country, sometimes from all over the world. And our counselors sit down and say, this is worth this and this and this. And we try to say, we call back to the school to say, were they on track to graduate? And they say, yes, they were. And they said, so then we feel it's an obligation at our school to figure out how to make those credits line up with what the state has as the requirements to help them graduate on time, because we just feel that's our duty. And especially with our Coast Guard and other kids, because we're a city where the Coast Guard is, we really felt that was really important, that they shouldn't have to take another year because we have a requirements different. So we work on that really hard, and we try to figure out fairly quickly in conversations with those students whether or not they have the skills to participate in the courses and the coursework that we have that works that graduation. So we have had the opportunity at our school, at the high school when I was principal, to have three of our students who were on the national board for the AP programs. They have a student board, and we've had kids over the years that were on those student boards, and they would come back and share with our school all the conversations that went on with the students about how rigorous these programs were, what was important, what kind of questions to have. We had these kids that came from Coos Bay and flew back to New York to be on these boards, and then when they went to college, they continued to be on the board to have conversations. And so we felt pretty comfortable at the school about what it meant to be an AP course. Our teachers were trained at different places around to grade papers, so they felt pretty comfortable in saying, if you do this on that test, you're going to make it. And our kids performed really well. Had kids, my own students, who went through that program and got credits at the University of Oregon. They got credits at USC. They got credits at the schools that they chose to go to. And yet, you'll find that when you talk to some of our community college and stuff, some kids will get X credit because that's what's decided. They could have gone to Stanford and got more, so it would have been probably easier to go to a less rigorous school than our other community colleges to go and to get the credits. That drives me crazy. I just believe that there should be a standard. I've heard them say, well, it's not the same course. Every year it changes a little bit. They do change a little bit. I don't know that you need to have a whole group of people decide how big that change was. I think you could do it simpler than that. But from my perspective, I think what you're teaching kids what to do is how to think, how to take source material, how to make it your own, and do something with it. And that's the power of education. You know, my daughter has written back to her AP teacher a number of times. She's a playwright in New York right now, saying, the fact that you made us go to source material, the fact that I got to do these kind of things changed my life with respect to how I approach things and how I do it. When she went to college, she found many of the courses much easier. When I was at the University of Washington in math, it was interesting because one term the math class covered X amount, and the next term it may not have covered quite as much. If you happened to be on the one that didn't cover quite as much, when you went to the next course, you were expected to have covered it. So it was your responsibility as a student to learn the material you needed to do to be successful at the next level. That's part of what this whole experience is about, is to make you as an individual responsible for your own education to move forward and do the things that have to. We understand the expectations of colleges. I'm saying that here's a program that has been designed with AP, and I hope we can get something with IB at some point. Here's a program that has been designed. They have people from all over the country who are educated college professors helping design what the curriculum would be and basically say, here we go. Here's the kind of rigor that you have to have. Here's the course you have to have. And at the end of the day, they don't ask the individual teacher to grade it. They say, you're going to take a test that's going to go back to someplace else and it's going to be graded independently, and that's how you're going to get your score. For me, it is a perfect example of how to get people, and students in particular, to the place where they need to be those active, engaged college students. And when those credits that they know what they're going to get before they go, when parents know that the investment and time and effort is going to pay off for me, then they are more encouraged to do it. We have spent a lot of money in the state now paying for kids to take some of these tests because we thought it was important enough to do it. It would be nice if we get the return on that. And it's really the return on the students' investment in their time and in their knowledge to do those things. And for me, it's a standard across the nation. It's not just a standard that's for my individual school or whatever. Those are important things, and I believe this is a great way of letting kids know that their effort is valued, that the course has standards which are pretty high and that are accepted across the nation in lots of our schools, and I would hope that Oregon can come to a way to make that happen for our kids. That's why I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We always enjoy having you.
It's great to be here.
Yep. And either Pam or Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, other members of the committee. For the record, I'm Terry Whitney, Government Relations Director, West Region for the College Board. We're pleased to deliver testimony in support of Senate Bill 207. My colleague to my right is a national expert on AP, and we will use the bulk of our time for her remarks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Pam Kerouac. I'm Senior Director for the AP Higher Ed Program for the College Board. I'm here as an advocate for AP students in our care and the AP Oregon students in your care. I'll have a few points to make, and then I'm available for questions that you might have for me. So I ask for your support of Senate Bill 207. The reason that we advocate and champion system-wide AP credit policies in states like Oregon is so that we are able to establish evidence-based credit policies. Too often, credit policies for AP are established based on subjective opinion and bias. We often welcome and engage higher ed faculty. We do this annually throughout the development of AP curriculum, through the scoring of AP exams. All those processes involve faculty from around the nation, including 56 faculty from Oregon. So everything that AP represents is in alignment with what college-level learning is expected for students. What we want to make sure is that when students have put forth all of this effort and really demonstrated the college-level learning through an externally assessed exam, that they are recognized for that achievement and earn credit based on minimum scores of 3 and higher. You might wonder why we're setting the minimum score requirement at 3. We conduct research studies on placement validity throughout the nation on a regular, ongoing basis. In every study, we find that students scoring 3 on AP exams perform as well or better than the non-AP students in the sequent course. In other words, when they can exempt from that introductory college course and place into the next course, that in all of the studies, we see those students performing as well or better than non-AP students who took the intro course. It's a testament to not only the level of content they've learned through the AP experience, but also to the depth of learning and the skills they've learned on how to apply that learning. So much of the focus on AP redesign has asked students, particularly in the AP redesign subjects, to be able to express their depth of learning, their ability to think critically, their ability to compare and contrast and develop reasoned arguments beyond just regurgitating content knowledge and filling in a multiple choice exam. Students taking an AP exam are expected to provide their answers through a free response section on the exam. Those free response or short essay or essay questions are graded annually every June by thousands of higher ed faculty throughout the nation. This is part of what we call standardizing or ensuring through rubric-based assessment that what students are demonstrating for scores of 3s, 4s, and 5s represent a national standard of college-level learning and achievement. The other thing I want to say for Oregon students is we know that Oregon, like many states, has struggled with 4-year graduation rates. The Chronicle of Higher Ed is now reporting that Oregon has a 30% graduation rate for 4-year colleges and universities. The 6-year rate is 55%. Half of the students in Oregon successfully transfer from the community college system into the 4-year institutions in Oregon. We have to wonder what happens to them, that they're not graduating in 4 and even 6 years. So our ask of you is to support this bill so that we reduce the duplication of excess credit that students do not need. We address the affordability options that students do need, and that we're able to help those students who know this material advance into the course that will challenge them and keep them on track to meet graduation requirements. Thank you, and I'm open for questions.
Okay, thank you. I think I have a lot better understanding of what really happens during the process. Rep Reschke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming. Just so I understand, AP is scored on 1 to 5. Okay, I'm getting yeses on that, then a follow-up real quick. And this bill would say anything 3 to 5 is then must be accepted by an Oregon University, Oregon Community College as college credit. Is that, I'm seeing heads bob up and down, so that's good. My third follow-up, are there any classes today that someone can score a 3 and that's accepted at a college, or is the problem that you're trying to solve is this arbitrary right now?
It is arbitrary. There are a number of subjects across the institutions in Oregon that AP subjects that require scores of 4. And those scores for AP subjects seem to be going up each year. I think we heard in the Education Committee conversation last time, it's like moving the goalposts every year. Students in the high schools think that they're going to earn credit with a score of 3, and then the committee comes back annually and says, oops, we've just raised the score to 4. And what we're seeing is those scores are being raised in the AP redesign subjects like physics and calculus, where those subjects are very robust and very rigorous, expecting that a student present a score of 4 or 5 is comparable to a college grade of a B or a high A. 4 comparing to a score B, 5 comparing to an A. An exam grade, a score of 3 compares to a C plus to a B minus. So we're asking that there's some thoughtful consideration about transferability based on what we know students can do with college grades of C plus to A. So changing those score requirements each year, again, just produces more barriers for students who should not be facing those barriers.
Okay. Dr. Johnson, still have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't think anybody that I'm aware of questions the value of the rigor of AP courses.
Right.
I mean, this state, maybe you're aware, just passed a ballot measure in November called Ballot Measure 98. One of those components in that ballot measure is encouraging school districts to provide more AP course, IB course type opportunities, because we do know that it improves performance, helps students stay on track. They graduate at a rate better than students who don't. The question that I think this committee has, and that we also are very interested in, is not just, you mentioned the alignment with college level learning. Great, we acknowledge that. What we're concerned about, though, is the alignment with the credits that are actually applicable in the next either community college or university setting, because what we're currently doing with giving a credit for a 3, it's great, you get some credits, but you're not assured that that is actually aligned with the degree pathway at the next level. And that's really the work I think that we need to do here, so that we don't end up with more empty credits. I mean, I wouldn't think you're advocating for that either.
No.
You know, we had a report from our Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, I think, last week, where they and talk about Oregon Promise applicants and so forth. Remember, we actually had a couple folks who didn't qualify for the Oregon Promise because they already used up their 90 credits in high school, which is okay if that all applied at the next level. And I think we just don't want to create a situation where we are creating volumes of credits that just don't have that applicability at the next level yet. So we're engaged in some really serious work on credit transfer, and I think what you're aspiring to and this work can really go hand in hand. So I just wanted to make that statement.
And I just want to thank you so much for that comment. Most of the states who are supporting exemplary models of system-wide policy for AP have, in this implementation phase, have aligned the AP subjects to the general education core that they've established and those transfer pathways, because it doesn't do us any good to grant a boatload of elective credits to AP students. That just simply is deceptive to the student and really is not helpful for the student.
Okay, co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Chair, could you please, the figures you gave us on the graduation rates for Oregon, was that state schools or all colleges, and what is your source for that? If you don't have that, could you provide it through
sure.
the matter?
The Chronicle of Higher Education College Completion produces a data analysis for each state. So the figures I shared with you are on their site for 2013, so that I'm not sure they've updated that since then. And this is for 4-year public institutions in Oregon.
Thank you.
Sure. They also break it down and show by demographic variables. So for African American, Hispanic, you'll see the data even change more drastically.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'll hold my question. Okay. Well, thank you all for your excellent testimony. I'm going to call up next with Susan Walsh, Mike Bailey, and John Wyckoff. And appreciate Susan, driving all the way up from Southern.
Thank you.
They're beautiful. Did you come up this morning? Or?
Yes, just got here this afternoon. Thank you.
Beautiful
Chair
day.
Reardon. And thank you as well, Vice Chairs Alonzo Leon and Wisnet. I am Susan Walsh from Southern Oregon University. I'm currently Provost and Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs. And I just am here today to briefly talk about the support that Oregon public universities have for the status quo system that we have in place for accepting AP credit. I believe the Provost Council has submitted written testimony to this group, and so I'll skip that part and just sort of cut right to the message. We fully support the intent of the bill for awarding more advanced college credit and also providing a predictable environment for students who seek the AP credits. These are our students, and we want them to succeed. We know that they have academic promise and motivation, and dual credit is one way in which we can reward that motivation and path to success. However, we have the following concerns with the bill, and we ask the committee to seriously consider these concerns as you determine how you'll vote on it. We worry that we may be creating false expectations for students. We want students to succeed and have realistic expectations to succeed in college. And the accepted AP scores are posted on the university and HEC websites and show test scores, credits awarded for the scores, and course equivalencies in the major, which is very specific to the subject area. If universities and colleges are required to accept scores that may not represent college-level work, there are two possible outcomes. And Representative Johnson touched on one of them, so I'll touch on it briefly. Colleges and universities could award credits as electives instead of credits counting toward the major. So students will have credits, which is great, but that may, in fact, prohibit them from completing on time and also might increase their debt load. Students may also be unprepared for the next college-level course in the sequence and could even get discouraged and possibly drop out of school. And so we worry about persistence in that regard. We also feel that we have a system that's working. We have a statewide advanced placement and International Baccalaureate Work Group, or the IB, and policies that the HEC oversee. For example, for over a decade, the universities and community colleges have collaborated quite successfully through AP and IB work to evaluate the equivalency of high school courses and award credit by exam for proficiencies and map them to college-level courses. So it's the mapping and alignment that was touched on earlier. And our faculty work with AP and IB folks to assist in calibrating the exams and also participate in workshops to train the high school faculty. So we feel that the current system works. It honors the role of faculty to oversee academic quality, and it complies with our current accreditation standards. The community colleges, the public universities, and the private universities all agree that it's not broken at this point in time.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Chair Reardon, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Mike Bailey. I'm a professor at Oregon State University. Orange necktie, should have been obvious. I've been a professor for over 30 years. I've been involved with curriculum committees across the university, through departments, through the colleges, at the university level. And I'm testifying today to express my concerns with Senate Bill 207. As faculty members, we do fully support the intent of the bill. These are our brightest students that we're talking about, and we want them to succeed, and we want them to stay challenged and motivated. However, I have concerns with the bill that center on our ability to deliver student success to all students. I don't think it's wise to include a specific score in the statute. A basic principle of university academics is that our faculty's job is to oversee the curricular matters. University faculty are responsible for establishing and maintaining curriculum, program requirements, and academic quality. Letting the faculty determine the applicability of AP test success, as we do now, is intended to maximize the likelihood that the students will succeed not only in the courses they're taking right now, but in the ones that we know are coming downstream. Faculty know better than anyone how the material on the AP test and its scoring matches up against their own courses. SB 207 removes that oversight. Requiring universities to accept AP credits regardless of how AP tests change over time or how our classes change over time, undermines our resolve to give every student the maximum opportunity for success. We're also very concerned that this bill could undermine our accreditation. The public universities in Oregon are accredited by the NWCCU, the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, and they state that credit is to be awarded, quote, only for documented student achievement equivalent to expected learning achievement for courses within the institution's regular curricular offerings, unquote, and, quote, only upon the recommendation of appropriately qualified teaching faculty. The NWCCU is basically, with this language, asking to have the faculty make this determination. I think this should be stated, and maybe I'm letting out a big secret, but faculty really, really want these bright students to get out of the beginning courses. I know there's an impression somewhere that we're trying to hold them in, and we're not. It benefits them, it benefits the bright students because, well, they get on to more challenging academic adventures. But it also benefits the ones that are still in that course. And that's important to us because now they're in a cohort of roughly peers. The teachers can teach to that group without the bright students getting bored. And it sends a message, if the students in that class are in there with the extremely bright ones, it sends the message that, you know, maybe you don't really belong here. And that's something we desperately want to prevent. So we want to use the talents and experience of our faculty members to be sure that the knowledge that the students come in with actually does match up against the courses that they're testing out of and doesn't disadvantage them as they enter these courses or any of the downstream courses. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions so far?
Just over there.
Refreshki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bailey, you mentioned about accreditation. That got the few hairs I have on the back of my neck perking up. And
yeah, ours too.
and that would concern me greatly that we would pass something that could potentially down the road, you would lose accreditation in this program or that. What could you see as a possible solution then? Because the other side of this argument says you're moving the goalposts. Is there a way that you can publish in advance or more in advance so somebody taking an AP course this spring knows that they're going to get credit for that in the major that they're applying for in the fall? Or when is that published, I guess?
Yes, yeah, Sue actually is. Well, you mentioned it. I don't want to steal your numbers.
No, that's quite all right. I believe I understand the question. I think that the disconnect is what you're trying to avoid, so that
I'm taking an AP course, mm-hmm. and I know I need to get a 3. Mm-hmm. I think I need to get a 3, and then I find out when I apply at SOU, no, it's a 4, so I have to take physics all over again in order to apply to my major.
So I have not encountered that particular problem. I don't think that happens on a regular basis. I think those are all print. They're all published and made available in advance. So the predictability argument, which
yes.
I understand,
yeah.
is what you're asking about, is less of a problem from the university standpoint. We feel that the information is provided, and that there's less missing information than I think our colleagues might think there are.
Okay.
And more importantly, it's provided with the knowledge of the faculty that are teaching those courses and the downstream courses
right.
about what will be required for those students to succeed.
Okay.
Yeah. So can I add just one more point? At Southern, we have, this year, we'll have approximately 12,000 student credit hours in dual credit at SOU, mm-hmm. much of which is AP. So I think that would indicate that the accessibility and knowledge and awareness of on the part of the students is there.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to ask one short question, and I think we have a couple of more as well. So, did I, I've been trying to understand this, did I understand that somebody could earn a 4 on a whatever test mm-hmm. and at one institution get a different number of credits than at some other institution?
That's a great question. I think that it probably does happen. I think that within the state of Oregon and our university system, mm-hmm. not as frequently, not at if at all. But I can't speak to the national average on that. I think within our system, which is what I know after 33 years, is unlikely that would happen.
We try very hard to make sure it doesn't.
The seven universities work pretty closely together, as do the community colleges and privates.
And the other one other thing, and then we've heard that the tests from other testimony that the tests are nationally normed and are graded on some campus. So I'm trying to think of a tactful way to say this. Are your faculty somehow much more superior to this other faculty?
I'll defer to my colleague. Oh, okay.
Here. It's late. Pardon my lack of candor.
Oh.
No,
certainly not. It's not an issue of whose faculty are better than whose other faculty. It's more of an issue of what's coming downstream. And different institutions have different ways of arranging the downstream courses. And so while the AP tests are graded on a national norm, that doesn't necessarily match up with every institution in exactly the same way.
And that's what we're trying to address.
Right.
Okay, just for clarity. So, Vice Chair, wasn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, Doctor, some of your comments you made about the guy working with his peers, do you support competency-based education? Do you work on competency-based education?
We don't.
Concept, which is growing statewide in K-12 and also in higher education.
It's something we're looking at very closely. Again, we want to make sure the students succeed now and in the courses they're going to take in the future. What we're looking at is developing our own proficiency tests that we know match up with what's coming downstream. That's how we would establish competencies. Again, we would match up against what we know is coming.
Mr. Kocher, I meant to bring it for the committee. I think it was USA This Week had a young lady from Indiana who graduated from college before she graduated from high school.
Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, you referenced you had concerns about accreditation, but there's 20 other states in the country that already have this same law or very similar. Have you seen or heard of concerns or problems with their situation?
I don't know. We have a hard enough time keeping up with our own accreditors.
Okay. John? And we do have three other people.
Members
to
of the committee.
After John.
For the record, John Wyckoff, Oregon Community College Association. I just want to make a quick try to address a couple of the points that have come up. The first is sort of on the idea that the goalpost has been moving and that there is not uniformity. There is uniformity. The cut scores across the state are the same across every college and university. That work was done about 10 years ago. They have been unchanging. So I'm not sure what the issue is around the moving goalpost. I don't believe Oregon's goalpost has moved for about 10 years when that work was aligned. The issue then becomes not so much about rigor and whose faculty are better, it's whether the learning outcomes are aligned. And as this committee knows very well, aligning learning outcomes, aligning curriculum is not just a wave of the wand. It requires real work. It requires convening faculty. It requires making sure the outcomes line up. To the question about so within the state, yes, all of our scores line up. Does that mean that if, to use an example that was used earlier, if Stanford requires a 3 and say for one of our classes we require a 4, no, Stanford may not give the same number of credits. Stanford may be giving 9, whereas we might be giving 15 for our 4. So it's very difficult, unless you really get into the details, to compare state to state and call it apples to apples without you seeing what they're doing. And the last point I would make is the issue of alignment, it drives into, are the students getting credits they need for the majors that they want to go into? And this is why we care so much about alignment, why we're so passionate about having credits go into our guided pathways and then transfer into universities seamlessly. And we want to make sure that that hard work is done here. Just flooding the zone with more and more accelerated credit isn't going to get us anywhere. And we can't just assume, what I think I heard before was, well, no, the work of alignment just happens later, that'll happen later. Well, that's hard work. And we can't just assume that that is going to happen after without contemplating how and when that work will be done. So that would be our concern, is that you can flood the zone with lots of accelerated credit, but if it's a lot of elective credit, as you heard in testimony last week from both Mount Hood Community College and Chemeketa, that we've had students come in ineligible for the Oregon Promise because they already have 90 credits, and they're still far from receiving their associate's degree because so many of their credits are elective. And that's our primary concern, is that we want to make sure students are getting credits that actually count towards a major, because if they don't, they're burning up their financial aid eligibility without actually making as much progress as they could. And with that, I will conclude.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Committee, I'm going to have to ask you to stick around for just a little bit extra. We have three more people to testify. And Aaron Weeks, Lynn King, and Ross Stern, please. And thank you for staying a little bit late as well. Appreciate that.
All right, we'll try and be brief. Chair Reardon, Vice Chairs Alonzo, Leon, and Wisnet. My name is Erin Weeks Earp, and I work for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission Policy Specialist. I staff the APIB work group that we've been discussing. When this bill came to the Senate, I came and informed the Senate Ed Committee about the work of that work group and how the policy at the state level functions. So I wanted to briefly give you that background as well and answer any questions that you might have about our statewide course credit policy. The Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate statewide course credit policy represents consensus among Oregon institutions on the minimum scores and transferable credits for the APIB exams. The policy is designed to provide transparency and consistency to students as they plan their high school course taking, exam taking, and post-secondary degrees and certificates. As you may know, the HEC inherited this statewide work group from the Joint Boards of Education and the former Oregon University System in 2014. That work group had been meeting since 2005, when upon passage of Senate Bill 342, Oregon's public colleges and universities were directed to develop uniform standards for awarding college credit for advanced placement. Later, the Joint Boards of Education directed the work group to include international baccalaureate programs in their statewide work. So the policy includes a tabulated list of exam scores, the number of credits, and the number of courses that estimate that should be awarded. Each academic year, our review committee comes together. It meets three times, once in person, twice by phone, and it looks at only those subjects that have been updated. So in the entire policy, not every subject is reviewed, only the ones that have had curricular changes. So that's 3 to 5 subjects per year across AP and IB. The first meeting, they get all of the curriculum frameworks and descriptions of the changes. They take that back to their faculty departments in the fall. The faculty make recommendations based on the curricular review that they do, and so they stay very engaged in what might be happening at the subject level. They bring the recommendations back to the statewide group, which negotiates what change the policy might take, or the policy might stay the same. In my experience, the policy has often stayed the same, or they have a negotiated process by which they change the policy, but that's more rare. In January, the committee recommends the policy, and then we go through a series of stakeholder feedback. We bring the policy, of course, actually this week to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission subcommittee. It's adopted by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It's reviewed previously before that by the academic leadership at community colleges and at public universities. It goes at an informational item to the Joint Transfer and Articulation Committee and the State Board of Education. So we try and get the word out about the review and the changes widely to groups that are interested. It's posted on our website. The institutions have it on their website, and we spread the word with the Department of Education to school counselors as well. If you have any questions about the process, I'd be happy to answer them, but I know we're stuck for time, and our partners from the IB are here. I'd like to also thank Pam for being here. She is the statewide expert on AP, and the HEC is very supportive of the rigorous AP programs and our partnership with the College Board. What we do have in Oregon is a system that does ensure engagement with our university faculty and the AP curriculum, and that engagement isn't always smooth, but is a good dialogue, which I think is the most important part of the faculty engaging with the curriculum and then the students that come to them.
Question?
Good afternoon, Chairman.
One question, please.
Sure.
Do you know this process that we go through on an annual basis, do you know the cost of that?
I don't have a budget. No, that means zero. There's no cost. There's staff time. There's time from the universities that administers that the administrators that serve on the committee, but we don't disperse any. We don't have a budget for that committee.
Are there
advisory?
Are there people that travel around the state to attend these meetings? And
they're institutionally supported to attend the one meeting in the fall. The other meetings are by phone.
Okay, it's. Love to have more information on that at some point, because we're constantly asked here about the cost of everything we do.
Right.
We couldn't get a $2,000 task force. I'm not venting or anything. I'm just sharing information. And we couldn't get a $2,000 task force this year. So we're sensitive about costs. So that's why I was asking.
Yeah. Well, people's time is not a no cost, but it hasn't been a budget item for the HEC. We inherited it from the Oregon University system and continued the statewide dialogue on awarding of AP credit. Okay. It's a pretty cost-effective way to ensure that students are treated well when they arrive at the universities with their AP knowledge.
Okay, great. Okay. Lynn?
Hi.
Thank you.
Chairman Reardon, vice chairs, and members of the committee, my name is Lynn King. I'm the executive director for the Northwest Association of IB World Schools. We cover 5 states, and I was previously an IB coordinator in Woodburn. Our organization was really surprised to hear of SB 207 and its approval in the Senate, as this bill really speaks to only one group of students that are working hard to extend their learning, to work hard and increase their learning and the additional coursework, and possibly gain college credit, which would hopefully decrease their student loans, which you haven't heard about earlier. But also with the possibility of this becoming a statute, which would be mandated, it avoids the work that the HEC does, which was previously Oregon University System. And it does very well, it works very well, it has annual reviews. And so it's something that is in place and working well, which we don't understand why there would need to be a change to it. As an organization that does not have a lobbyist, we're a nonprofit group, we understand that we could propose a bill in February that would implement IB into the same position as the college board. But what happens when programs change? This is with the IB. We originally started out as a diploma program. Since then, we've added several other program levels where we go K-12. And most recently, we added the career-related program. So that would mean that statutes would then have to modify and adapt to these changes that are going on or are happening. So we would just like to encourage you to understand that the current system is working well, and our students are getting into colleges, are receiving college credit, and doing well with their coursework. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, whatever. Mr. Dern?
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Reardon, vice chairs and committee. Thanks for the opportunity. I feel like that I'm coming into this in the fourth quarter, having not been around for the first 3, because I have not been involved in this process of this bill. I'm retired. I have taught AP for a number of years in my early career. I taught IB at the end of my career a lot longer. I was an IB coordinator for 22 years in the state. I've been involved in following this issue of course credit for more than two decades. I was on the first committee that got together that started with the AP and IB course credit back in, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. I'm here because I'm interested in this, but I'm here because my colleagues and the IB coordinators are all giving IB exams today, and they needed some people, and I said I'd come, okay? So I was here listening, and most of what the points I've made have been made. It seems to me we have a system that really works already, and it works well. As both Aaron and Lynn have pointed out, maybe we do need to codify that into law. I don't know. I don't understand, though, why the law that's written refers to only one of the external exam systems that we are rightly recognized for credit, and that's the AP. I think it needs to involve the IB, and if it involved the IB, I would probably be supportive of it. But then the question comes up, as we heard from our college representatives a while ago, do we want to set a designated thing? And I think that's a higher question. But I think on the face of it, the idea that, number one, we have a system that works, and number two, we have a law here that only gives credit to AP, I think is not supportable.
Warn them all out. So, all right. Thank you very much for all of your testimony. Anybody else in the audience? Anybody still going out there? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 207A. And just to state again for the public record, we do not have time to hear Senate Bill 54A or Senate Bill 206A, but we will hear them next Tuesday, May 16th, Election Day, for those of you who are so inclined, hopefully.
I'm on the ballot.
Yeah. I'll be voting, yeah.
Rep. Johnson?
Yeah, just a point, Mr. Chair. Yeah, exactly. I think I would just say, I think that the two bills we had in front of us today are great evidence of the value of having a higher ed committee versus a gen ed committee as we have in the other chamber. Not that they don't do their work and haven't, but I think it gives us the opportunity to really take a deeper dive into some of these issues, and I really think that's the intent of what this committee is all about. And I think we're just having a great opportunity to, you know, shine some fresh eyes on some of these concepts and hopefully improve them in a way that can really be good for the system.
Yeah, thank you. I totally agree. And sometimes I look at the number of bills and think, well, maybe we could. But we do some really deep stuff here, and really appreciate everybody's great questions today and the input. And I would hope that maybe the co-chairs could meet with me tomorrow to chat over what we've heard today. That would be very helpful. So I'm closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. Great job. Great job. Workforce Development Committee.